She had, by degrees, slid her body along the desk so that now, he could not understand how it had been accomplished, she rested almost entirely against him. My God, he thought, it was impossible. Listen, he said, swallowing and finding his throat dry. He could hardly croak out the words. Get going and let me read my newspaper. Grabbing up the paper, he held it between himself and her. Go on, he said gratingly. The shape ebbed a little.
What's the matter, Arnie?
Her voice purred, like metal wheels rubbing, an automatic sound coming forth from her, like on a recording, he thought. He said nothing. He gripped his paper and read. When he next looked up, the girl had gone. He was alone. I don't remember that, he said to himself, quaking inside, down deep within his stomach. What kind of a creature was that? I don't get it. What was happening just then? He began automatically to read an item in the paper about a ship which had been lost in deep space, a freighter from Japan carrying a cargo of bicycles. He felt amused, even though 300 people aboard had perished. It was just too goddamn funny, the idea of all those thousands of little light Jap bikes floating as debris, circling the sun forever. Not that they weren't needed on Mars with its virtual lack of power sources. A man could pedal free of cost for hundreds of miles in the planet's slight gravity. Reading further, he came across an item about a reception at the White House for... He squinted. The words seemed to run together. He could hardly read them. Printing error of some kind? What did it say? He held the newspaper closer. Gubble, gubble, it said. The article became meaningless, nothing but the gubble, gubble words one after another. Good grief. He stared at it in disgust, his stomach reacting. His duodenal ulcer hurt worse than ever now. He had become tense and angry, the worst possible combination for an ulcer patient, especially at mealtime. Darn those gubble, gubble words, he said to himself. That's what that kid says. They sure spoil the article in the paper. Glancing through the paper, he saw that almost all the articles devolved into nonsense, became blurred after a line or so. His irritation grew, and he tossed the paper away. What the hell good is it like that? He asked himself. That's that schizophrenia talk, he realized. Private language. I don't like that here at all. It's okay if he wants to talk like that himself, but it doesn't belong here. He's got no right to push that stuff into my world. And then Arnie thought, of course, he did bring me back here, so maybe he thinks that does give him the right. Maybe the boy thinks of this as his world. That thought did not please Arnie. He wished it had never come to him. Getting up from his desk, he went over to the window and looked down at the street of Lewistown far below. People hurrying along, how fast they went. And the cars, too. Why so fast? There was an unpleasant kinetic quality to their movements, a jerkiness. They seemed either to bang into one another or to be about to. Colliding objects like billiard balls, hard and dangerous. The buildings, he noticed, seemed to bristle with sharp corners. And yet, when he tried to pinpoint the change, and it was a change, no doubt of that, he could not. This was the familiar scene he saw every day. And yet, were they moving too fast? Was that it? No, it was deeper than that. There was an omnipresent hostility in everything. Things did not merely collide. They struck one another, as if doing it deliberately. And then he saw something else, something which made him gasp. The people on the street below, hurrying back and forth, had almost no faces, just fragments or remnants of faces, as if they had never formed. Aw, this will never do, Arnie said to himself. He felt fear now, deeply and intensely. What's going on? What are they handing me? He returned, shaken, to his desk and sat down again. Picking up his cup of coffee, he drank, trying to forget the scene below, trying to resume his routine of the morning. The coffee had a bitter, acrid, foreign taste to it, and he had to set the cup back down at once. I suppose the kid imagines all the time he's being poisoned, Arnie thought in desperation. Is that it? I gotta find myself eating awful-tasting food because of his delusions? God, he thought, that's terrible. Best thing for me, he decided, is to get my task here done as fast as possible and then get back to the present. Unlocking the bottom drawer of his desk, Arnie got out the little battery-powered encoding dictation machine and set it up for use. Into it, he said, Scott, I got a terribly important item here to transmit to you. I insist you act on this at once. What I want to do is buy into the FDR Mountains because the UN is going to establish a gigantic housing tract area there, specifically around the Henry Wallace Canyon. Now you transfer enough union funds, in my name, of course, to ensure that I get title to all that, because in about 2 weeks, speculators from... He broke off, for the encoding machine had grown to a stop. He poked at it, and the reels turned slowly and then once more settled back into silence. Thought it was fixed, Arnie thought angrily. Didn't that Jack Bolin work on it? And then he remembered that this was back in the past, before Jack Bolin had been called in. Of course it didn't work. I've got to dictate it to that secretary creature, he realized. He started to press the button on his desk that would summon her, but drew back. How can I let that back in here? He asked himself. But there was no alternative. He pressed the button. The door opened, and she came in.
I knew you would want me, Arnie, she said, hurrying toward him, strutting and urgent.
Listen, he said, with authority in his voice. Don't get too close to me. I can't stand it when people get too close. But even as he spoke, he recognized his fears for what they were. It was a basic fear of the schizophrenic that people might get too close to him, might encroach into his space. Nearness fear, it was called. It was due to the schizophrenic's sensing hostility in everyone around him. That's what I'm doing, Arnie thought. And yet, even knowing this, he could not endure having the girl come close to him. He got abruptly to his feet and walked away, back once more to the window.
Anything you say, Arnie,
the girl said in a tone that was insatiable, and despite what she said, she crept toward him until, as before, she was almost touching him. He found himself hearing the noises of her breathing, smelling her, the sour body scent, her breath, which was thick and unpleasant. He felt choked, unable to get enough air into his lungs. I'm going to dictate to you now, he said, walking away from her, keeping distance between the two of them. This is to Scott Temple and should go in code so they can't read it. They, he thought. Well, that had always been his fear. He couldn't blame that on the boy. I got a terribly important item here, he dictated. Act on it at once. It means plenty. It's a real inside tip. The UN's going to buy a huge hunk of land in the FDR Mountains. On and on he dictated, and even as he talked, a fear assailed him, an obsessive fear that grew each moment. Suppose she was just writing down those gubble-gubble words. I just gotta look, he told himself. I gotta walk over close to her and see. But he shrank from it, the closeness. Listen, miss, he said, interrupting himself. Give me that pad of yours. I want to see what you're writing.
Arnie, she said in her rough, dragging voice, you can't tell anything by looking at it.
What? He demanded in fright.
It's in shorthand.
She smiled at him coldly with what seemed to him palpable malevolence. Okay, he said, giving up. He went on and completed his dictation, then told her to get it into code and off to Scott at once.
And what then? She said.
What do you mean?
You know, Arnie,
she said, and the tone in which she said it made him cringe with dismay and pure physical disgust. Nothing after that, he said. Just get out. Don't come back. Following after her, he slammed the door shut behind her. I guess, he decided, I'll have to contact Scott direct. I can't trust her. Seating himself at the desk, he picked up the telephone and dialed. Presently, the line was ringing, but it rang in vain. There was no response. Why, he wondered. Has he run out on me? Is he against me? Working with them? I can't trust him. I can't trust anybody. And then, all at once, a voice said, Hello, Scott Temple speaking. And he realized that only a few seconds and a few rings had actually gone by. All those thoughts of betrayal, of doom, had flitted through his mind in an instant. This is Arnie. Hi, Arnie, what's up? I can tell by your tone something's cooking. Spill it. My sense of time is fouled up, Arnie realized. It seemed to me the phone rang for half an hour, but it wasn't at all. Arnie, Scott was saying, speak up, Arnie, are you there? It's the schizophrenic confusion, Arnie realized. It's basically a breakdown in time sense. Now I'm getting it because that kid has it. Christ's sake, Scott said, outraged. With difficulty, Arnie broke his chain of thought and said, Scott, listen. I got an inside scoop. We have to act on this right now, you understand? In detail, he told Scott about the UN and the FDR Mountains. So you can see, he wound up, it's worth it to us to buy in with all we got, and pronto. You agree?
You're sure of this scoop? Scott said.
Yeah, I am, I am.
How come?
Frankly, Arnie, I like you, but I know you get crazy schemes. You're always flying off at a tangent. I'd hate to get stuck with that dog's breakfast FDR land. Arnie said, "Take my word for it."
"I can't."
He could not believe his ears.
"We've been working together for years, and it's always been on a word-of-mouth confidence basis," he choked. "What's going on, Scott?"
"That's what I'm asking you," Scott said calmly. "How come a man of your business experience could bite on this phony nothing so-called scoop? The scoop is that the FDR range is worthless, and you know it. I know you know it. Everybody knows it. So what are you up to?"
You don't trust me?"
"Why should I trust you? Prove you got real inside scoop stuff here and not just your usual hot air." With difficulty, Arnie said, "Hell, man, if I could prove it, you wouldn't have to trust me. It wouldn't involve trust."
"Okay, I'll go into this alone, and when you find out what you missed, blame yourself, not me."
He slammed down the phone, shaking with rage and despair. What a thing to happen. He couldn't believe it. Scott Temple, the one person in the world he could do business with over the phone. The rest of them you could throw in the ocean, they were such crooks.
"It's a misunderstanding," he told himself,
but based on a deep, fundamental, insidious distrust, a schizophrenic distrust, a collapse, he realized, of the ability to communicate. Standing up, he said aloud, "I guess I gotta go to Pax Grove myself and see the abstract people. Put in my claim." And then he remembered he would have to first stake his claim, actually go to the site in the FDR Mountains, and everything in him shrieked out in rebellion at that. At that hideous place where the building would one day appear. Well, there was no way out. First have a stake made for him in one of the union shops, then take a copter and head for the Henry Wallace. It seemed, thinking about it, an agonizingly difficult series of actions to accomplish. How could he do all that? First, he would have to find some union metal worker who could engrave his name for him on the stake. That might take days. Who did he know in the shops here in Lewistown who could do it for him? And if he didn't know the guy, how could he trust him? At last, as if swimming against an intolerable current, he managed to lift the receiver from the hook and place the call to the shop. "I'm so tired I can hardly move," he realized. "Why? What have I done so far today?" His body felt crushed flat with fatigue. "If only I could get some rest," he thought to himself. "If only I could sleep." It was late in the afternoon before Arnicott was able to procure the metal stake with his name engraved on it from the union shop and make arrangements for a WWU copter to fly him to the FDR Mountains. "Hi, Arnie," the pilot greeted him, a pleasant-faced young man from the union's pilot pool.
"Hi, my boy," Arnie murmured, as the pilot assisted him into the comfortable special leather seat which had been built for him at the settlement's fabric and upholstery shop.
As the pilot got into the seat ahead of him, Arnie said, "Now let's hurry because I'm late. I gotta get all the way there and then to the abstract office at Pax Grove."
"And I know we won't make it," he said to himself. "There just isn't enough time."
Chapter 16, the last chapter. The waterworkers union copter with good member Arnie Cott in it had hardly gotten into the air when the loudspeaker came on. "Emergency announcement. There is a small party of bleakmen out on the open desert at gyro compass point 4.65003, dying from exposure and lack of water. Ships north of Lewistown are instructed to direct their flights to that point with all possible speed and give assistance. United Nations law requires all commercial and private ships to respond." The announcement was repeated in the crisp voice of the UN announcer speaking from the UN transmitter on the artificial satellite somewhere overhead. Feeling the copter alter course, Arnie said, "Aw, come on, my boy." It was the last straw. They would never get to the FDR range, let alone to Pax Grove and the abstract office.
"I have to respond, sir," the pilot said. "It's the law."
Now they were above the desert, moving at good speed toward the intersect which the UN announcer had given. "Niggers," Arnie thought. "We have to drop everything we're doing to bail them out, the damn fools. And the worst part of it is that now I will meet Jack Bolin. It can't be avoided. I forgot about it. Now it's too late." Patting his coat pocket, he found the gun still there. That made him a little more cheerful. He kept his hand on it as the copter lowered for its landing. "Hope we can beat him here," he thought. But to his dismay, he saw that the Yee Company copter had landed ahead of him, and Jack Bolin was already busy giving water to the five bleakmen. "Damn it," he thought.
"Do you need me?"
Arnie's pilot called down from his seat.
"If not, I'll go on."
In answer, Jack Bolin called back, "I don't have much water for them." He mopped his face with his handkerchief, sweating in the hot sun.
"Okay," the pilot said, and switched off his blades.
To his pilot, Arnie said, "Tell him to step over here. Hopping out with a 5-gallon water can, the pilot strode over to Jack, and after a moment Jack ceased attending to the bleepman and walked toward Arnie Cott.
"You wanted me?" Jack said, standing there looking up at Arnie.
"Yes," Arnie said. "I'm going to kill you." He brought out his pistol and aimed it at Jack Bolin. The bleakmen had been filling their paca eggshells with water. Now they stopped. A young male, dark and skinny, almost naked under the ruddy Martian sun, reached backward behind him to his quiver of poisoned arrows. He drew an arrow forward, fitting it onto his bow, and in a single motion he fired the arrow. Arnie Cott saw nothing. He felt a sharp pain and looked down to see the arrow protruding from his chest, slightly below the breastbone.
"They read minds," Arnie thought. "Intentions." He tried to pull the arrow out, but it would not budge, and then he realized that he was already dying. It was poisoned, and he felt it entering his limbs, stopping his circulation, rising upward to invest his brain and mind.
Jack Bolin, standing below him, said, "Why would you want to kill me? You don't even know who I am."
"Sure I do," Arnie managed to grunt. "You're going to fix my encoder and take Doreen away from me, and your father will steal all I've got, all that matters to me, the FDR range and what's coming."
He shut his eyes and rested.
"You must be crazy," Jack Bolin said.
"Nah," Arnie said. "I know the future."
"Let me get you to a doctor," Jack Bolin said, leaping up into the copter, pushing aside the dazed young pilot to inspect the protruding arrow.
"They can give you an antidote if they get you in time."
He clicked on the motor. The blades of the copter began to turn slowly and then more quickly.
"Take me to the Henry Wallace," Arnie muttered, "so I can drive my claim stake."
Jack Bolin eyed him. "You're Arnie Cott, aren't you?"
Getting the pilot out of the way, he seated himself at the controls, and at once the copter began to rise into the air.
"I'll take you to Lewistown. It's closest, and they know you there."
Saying nothing, Arnie lay back, his eyes still shut. It had all gone wrong. He had not staked his claim, and he had not done anything to Jack Bolin. And now it was over.
"Those bleakmen," Arnie thought as he felt Bolin lifting him from the copter. This was Lewistown, he saw, through pain-darkened eyes, buildings, and people. "It's those bleakmen's fault from the start. If it wasn't for them, I never would have met Jack Bolin. I blame them for the whole thing." Why wasn't he dead yet? He wondered as Bolin carried him across the hospital's roof field to the emergency descent ramp. A lot of time had passed. The poison surely had gone all through him. And yet he still felt, thought, understood. "Perhaps I can't die back here in the past," he said to himself. "Maybe I gotta linger on, unable to die and unable to return to my own time." How did that young bleakman catch on so fast? They don't ordinarily use their arrows on Earth people. It's a capital crime. It means the end of them.
Maybe, he thought, they were expecting me. They conspired to save Bolin because he gave them food and water. Arnie thought, I bet they're the ones who gave him the water witch.
Of course. And when they gave it to him, they knew. They knew all about this, even back then at the very beginning.
I'm helpless in this terrible, damn schizophrenic past of Manfred Steiner's. Let me back to my own world, my own time. I just want to get out of here. I don't want to stake my claim or harm anybody. I just want to be back at Dirty Knobby in the cavern with that goddamn boy, like I was. Please, Arnie thought. Manfred.
Someone was wheeling him up a dark hall on a cart of some kind. Voices. Door opening, gleaming metal, surgical instruments. He saw masked faces, felt them lay him on a table.
"Help me, Manfred!" he shouted down deep inside himself. "They're gonna kill me! You have to take me back! Do it now or forget it, because—"
A mask of emptiness and total darkness appeared above him and was lowered.
"No!" Arnie cried out. "It's not over! It can't be the end of me! Manfred, for God's sake, before this goes further, and it's too late! Too late!"
"I must see the bright, normal reality once more, where there is not this schizophrenic killing and alienation and bestial lust and death. Help me get away from death, back where I belong once more. Help, Manfred. Help me."
A voice said, "Get up, mister. Your time has expired."
He opened his eyes.
"More cigarettes, mister."
The dirty ancient bleakman priest in his gray, cobweb-like robes bent over him, pawing at him, whining his litany again and again against his ear.
"If you want to stay, mister, you have to pay me."
He scratched at Arnie's coat, searching. Sitting up, Arnie looked for Manfred. The boy was gone.
"Get away from me," Arnie said, rising to his feet. He put his hands to his chest and felt nothing, no arrow there. He went unsteadily to the mouth of the cavern and squeezed out through the crack into the cold mid-morning sunlight of Mars.
"Manfred!"
he yelled. No sign of the boy. Well, he thought, anyhow, I'm back in the real world. That's what matters. And he had lost his desire to get Jack Bolin. He had lost his desire, too, to buy into the land development of these mountains. And he can have Doreen Anderton, for all I care, Arnie said to himself, as he started toward the trail up which they had previously come. But I'll keep my word to Manfred. I'll mail him to Earth first chance I get. And maybe the change will cure him, or maybe they have better psychiatrists back home by now. Anyhow, he won't wind up at that Amweb. As he made his way down the trail, still searching for Manfred, he saw a copter flying low overhead and circling. Maybe they saw where the boy went, he said to himself. Both of them, Jack and Doreen, must have been watching all this time. Halting, he waved his arms at the copter, indicating that he wanted it to land. The copter dropped cautiously until it rested up the trail from him, in the wide place before the entrance to Dirty Knobby. The door slid aside, and a man stepped out. "I'm looking for that kid," Arnie began. And then he saw that it was not Jack Bolin. It was a man he had never seen before. Good-looking, dark-haired, with wild, emotional eyes. A man who came toward him on a dead run, at the same time waving something that glinted in the sunlight.
"You're Arnie Cott,"
the man called to him in a shrill voice.
"Yeah, so what?"
Arnie said.
"You destroyed my field,"
the man shrieked at him, and raising the gun, fired. The first bullet missed Arnie. "Who are you, and why are you shooting at me?" Arnie Cott wondered as he groped in his coat for his own gun. He found it, brought it out, fired back at the running man. Then it came to him who this was. This was the feeble little black market operator who had been trying to horn in. "The one we gave that lesson to," Arnie said to himself. The running man dodged, fell, rolled over, and fired from where he lay. Arnie's shot had missed him, too. The shot whistled so close to Arnie this time that for a moment he thought he was hit. He put his hand instinctively to his chest. "Now," he realized, "you didn't get me, you bastard." Raising his pistol, Arnie aimed and prepared to fire once more at the figure. The world blew up around him. The sun fell from the sky. It dropped into darkness, and with it went Arnie Cott. After a long time, the prone figure stirred. The wild-eyed man crept to his feet cautiously, stood studying Arnie, and then started toward him. As he walked, he held his pistol with both hands and aimed it. A buzzing from above made him peer up. A shadow had swept over him, and now a second copter bumped to a landing between him and Arnie. The copter cut the two men off from one another, and Arnie Cott could no longer see the miserable little black market operator. Out of the copter leaped Jack Bolin. He ran over to Arnie and bent down.
"Get that guy," Arnie whispered.
"Can't," Jack said, and pointed. The black market operator had taken off. His copter rose above Dirty Knobby, floundered, then lurched forward, cleared the peak, and was gone. "Forget about him. You're badly shot. Think about yourself." Arnie whispered,
"Don't worry about it, Jack. Listen to me."
He caught hold of Jack's shirt and dragged him down so that Jack's ear was close by.
"I'll tell you a secret," Arnie said. "Something I've discovered. This is another of those schizophrenic worlds. All this goddamn schizophrenic hate and lust and death, it already happened to me once, and it couldn't kill me. First time, it was one of those poisoned arrows in the chest. Now this. I'm not worried."
He shut his eyes, struggling to keep himself conscious.
"Just dig up that kid. He's around somewhere. Ask him, and he'll tell you."
"You're wrong, Arnie," Jack said, bending down beside him.
"Wrong how?"
He could barely see Bolin now. The scene had sunk into twilight, and Jack's shape was dim and wraith-like.
"You can't fool me," Arnie thought. "I know I'm still in Manfred's mind. Pretty soon I'll wake up and I won't be shot. I'll be okay again, and I'll find my way back to my own world where things like this don't happen. Isn't that right?"
He tried to speak, but was unable to. Appearing beside Jack, Doreen Anderton said, "He's going to die, isn't he?" Jack said nothing. He was trying to get Arnie Cott over his shoulders so that he could lug him to the copter.
"Just another of those gubble-gubble worlds," Arnie said to himself as he felt Jack lift him. "It sure taught me a lesson, too. I won't do a nutty thing like this again."
He tried to explain that as Jack carried him to the copter.
"You just did this," he wanted to say. "Took me to the hospital at Lewistown to get the arrow out. Don't you remember?"
There's no chance, Jack said to Doreen as he set Arnie inside the copter, of saving him. He panted for breath as he seated himself at the controls.
Sure there is, Arnie thought with indignation. What's the matter with you? Aren't you trying? Better try, goddamn you.
He made an attempt to speak, to tell Jack that, but he could not. He could say nothing. The copter began to rise from the ground, laboring under the weight of the three people. During the flight back to Lewistown, Arnie Cott died. Jack Bolin had Doreen take the controls, and he sat beside the dead man, thinking to himself that Arnie had died still believing he was lost in the dark currents of the Steiner boy's mind. Maybe it's for the best, Jack thought. Maybe it made it easier for him at the last. The realization that Arnie Cott was dead filled him, to his incredulity, with grief. It doesn't seem right, he said to himself as he sat by the dead man. It's too harsh. Arnie didn't deserve it for what he did. The things he did were bad, but not that bad. What was it he was saying to you? Doreen asked. She seemed to be quite calm, to have taken Arnie's death in her stride. She piloted the copter with matter-of-fact skill. Jack said, he imagined this wasn't real, that he was blundering about in a schizophrenic fantasy. Poor Arnie, she said. Do you know who that man was who shot him? Some enemy he must have made along the way somewhere. They were both silent for a while. We should look for Manfred, Doreen said. Yes, Jack said. But I know where the boy is right now, he said to himself. He's found some wild bleakmen there in the mountains, and he's with them. It's obvious and certain, and it would have happened sooner or later in any case. He was not worried. He did not care about Manfred. Perhaps for the first time in his life the boy was in a situation to which he might make an adjustment. He might, with the wild bleakmen, discern a style of living which was genuinely his, and not a pallid, tormented reflection of the lives of those around him, beings who were innately different from him and whom he could never resemble, no matter how hard he tried. Doreen said, could Arnie have been right? For a moment he did not understand her, and then, when he had made out her meaning, he shook his head. No. Why was he so sure of it, then? Jack said, I don't know. But it had to do with Manfred. Arnie had said so just before he died. In many ways, Doreen said, Arnie was shrewd. If he thought that, there must have been some very good reason. He was shrewd, Jack pointed out, but he always believed what he wanted to believe. And, he realized, did whatever he wanted to. And so, at last, he had brought about his own death, engineered it somewhere along the pathway of his life. What's going to become of us now, Doreen said, without him? It's hard for me to imagine it without Arnie. Do you know what I mean? I think you do. I wish when we first saw that copter land we had understood what was going to happen. If only we had gotten down there a few minutes earlier. She broke off. No use saying that now. No use at all, Jack said briefly. You know what I think is going to happen to us now? Doreen said. We're going to drift away from each other, you and I. Maybe not right away, maybe not for months or possibly even years. But sooner or later we will, without him. He said nothing. He did not try to argue. Perhaps it was so. He was tired of struggling to see ahead to what lay before them all. Do you love me still? Doreen asked, after what's happened to us. She turned toward him to see his face as he answered. Yes, naturally I do, he said. So do I, she said in a low, wan voice. But I don't think it's enough. You have your wife and your son. That's so much in the long run. Anyhow, it was worth it, to me at least. I'll never be sorry. We're not responsible for Arnie's death. We mustn't feel guilty. He brought it on himself, by what he was up to there at the end. And we'll never know exactly what that was, but I know it was something to hurt us. He nodded. Silently, they continued on back to Lewistown, carrying with them the body of Arnie Cott, carrying Arnie home to his settlement where he was, and probably always would be, supreme good member of his Water Workers Union, Fourth Planet Branch. Ascending an ill-marked path in the arid rocks of the FDR Mountains, Manfred Steiner halted as he saw ahead of him a party of six dark, shadowy men. They carried with them paca eggs filled with water, quivers of poisoned arrows, and each woman had her pounding block. All smoked cigarettes as they toiled single file along the trail. Seeing him, they halted. One of them, a gaunt young male, said politely, "The rain's falling from your wonderful presence and vigor and restore us, mister." Manfred did not understand the words, but he got their thoughts. Cautious and friendly, with no undertones of hate. He sensed inside them no desire to hurt him, and that was pleasant. He forgot his fear of them and turned his attention on the animal skins which each wore. What sort of animal is that, he wondered. The Bleakmen were curious about him, too. They advanced until they stood around him on all sides. There are monster ships, one of them thought in his direction, landing in these mountains with no one aboard. They have excited wonder and speculation, for they appear to be a portent. Already they have begun to assemble themselves on the land to work changes. Are you from them, by any chance? No, Manfred answered, inside his mind, in a way for them to hear and understand. The Bleakman pointed, and he saw, toward the center of the mountain range, a fleet of UN slave rocket vehicles hovering in the air. They had arrived from Earth, he realized. They were here to break ground. The building of the tracts of houses had begun. Amweb and the other structures like it would soon be appearing on the face of the fourth planet. We are leaving the mountains because of that, one of the older Bleakman males thought to Manfred. There's no manner by which we can live here now that this has started. Through our rock we saw this long ago, but now it is here in actuality. Within himself, Manfred said, Can I go with you? Surprised, the Bleakman withdrew to discuss his request. They did not know what to make of him and what he wanted. They had never run across it in an immigrant before. We are going out into the desert, the young male told him at last. It is doubtful if we can survive there. We can only try. Are you certain you want that for yourself? Yes, Manfred said. Come along, then, the Bleakman decided. They resumed their trek. They were tired, but they swung almost at once into a good pace. Manfred thought at first that he would be left behind, but the Bleakman hung back for him, and he was able to keep up. The desert lay ahead, for them and for him. But none of them had any regrets. It was impossible for them to turn back anyhow, because they could not live under the new conditions. I will not have to live in Amweb, Manfred said to himself as he kept up with the Bleakman. Through these dark shadows I will escape. He felt very good, better than he could remember ever having felt before in his life. One of the Bleakman females shyly offered him a cigarette from those she carried. Thanking her, he accepted it. They continued on. And as they moved along, Manfred Steiner felt something strange happening inside him. He was changing. At dusk, as she was fixing dinner for herself and David and her father-in-law, Sylvia Boland saw a figure on foot, a figure that walked along the edge of the canal. A man, she said to herself. Frightened, she went to the front door, opened it, and peered out to see who it was. God, it wasn't that so-called health food salesman, that Otto, whatever his name was again. It's me, Sylvia, Jack Boland said. Running out of the house and up to his father excitedly, David shouted, Hey, how come you didn't bring your copter? Did you come on the tractor bus? I bet you did. What happened to your copter, Dad? Did it break down and strand you out in the desert? No more copter, Jack said. He looked tired. I heard on the radio, Sylvia said. About Arnicott? He nodded. Yeah, that's true. Entering the house, he took off his coat. Sylvia hung it in the closet for him. That affects you a lot, doesn't it? She said. Jack said, No job. Arnie had bought my contract. He looked around. Where's Leo? Taking his nap. He's been gone most of the day on business. I'm glad you got home before he goes. He's leaving for Earth tomorrow, he said. Did you know that the UN has started taking the land in the FDR range already? I heard that on the radio, too. I didn't know, Jack said, going into the kitchen and seating himself at the table. How about some iced tea? As she fixed the iced tea for him, she said, I guess I shouldn't ask you how serious this job business is. Jack said, I can get on with almost any repair outfit. Mr. Yee would take me back, as a matter of fact. I'm sure he didn't want to part with my contract in the first place. Then why are you so despondent? She said. And then she remembered about Arnie. It's a mile and a half from where that tractor bus let me off, he said. I'm just tired. I didn't expect you home. She felt on edge, and it was difficult for her to return to preparing dinner. We're only having liver and bacon and grated carrots with synthetic butter and a salad. And Leo said he'd like a cake of some sort for dessert. David and I were going to make that later on as a treat for him, because, after all, he is going, and we may not ever see him again. We have to face that. That's fine about the cake, Jack murmured. Sylvia burst out,
I wish you would tell me what's the matter. I've never seen you like this. You're not just tired. It must be that man's death.
Presently, he said, I was thinking of something Arnie said before he died. I was there with him. Arnie said he wasn't in a real world. He was in the fantasy of a schizophrenic, and that's been preying on my mind. It never occurred to me before how much our world is like Manfred's. I thought they were absolutely distinct. Now I see that it's more a question of degree.
You don't want to tell me about Mr. Cott's death, do you? The radio just said he was killed in a copter accident in the rugged terrain of the FDR Mountains.
It was no accident. Arnie was murdered by an individual who had it in for him, no doubt because he was mistreated and had a legitimate grudge. The police are looking for him now, naturally. Arnie died thinking it was senseless, psychotic hate that was directed at him, but actually it was probably very rational hate with no psychotic elements in it at all. With overwhelming guilt, Sylvia thought, the kind of hate you'd feel for me if you knew what awful thing I plunged into today.
Jack, she said clumsily, not sure how to put it, but feeling she had to ask. Do you think our marriage is finished?
He stared at her a long, long time.
Why do you say that?
I just want to hear you say it isn't.
It isn't, he said, still staring at her. She felt exposed, as if he could read her mind, as if he knew somehow exactly what she had done.
Is there any reason to think it is? Why do you imagine I came home? If we had no marriage, would I have shown up here today after... He was silent then.
I'd like my iced tea, he murmured.
After what? She asked.
He said, after Arnie's death.
Where else would you go?
A person can always find two places to choose from, home and the rest of the world with all the other people in it.
Sylvia said, what's she like?
Who?
The girl. You almost said it just now.
He did not answer for such a long time that she did not think he was going to. And then he said, she has red hair. I almost stayed with her, but I didn't. Isn't that enough for you to know?
There's a choice for me, too, Sylvia said.
I didn't know that, he said woodenly. I didn't realize.
He shrugged. Well, it's good to realize. It's sobering.
You're not speaking about theory now, are you? You're speaking about concrete reality.
That's correct, Sylvia said.
David came running into the kitchen.
Grandfather Leo's awake, he shouted. I told him you were home, Dad, and he's real glad and he wants to find out how things are going with you.
They're going swell, Jack said.
Sylvia said to him, Jack, I'd like for us to go on, if you want to.
Sure, he said. You know that. I'm back here again.
He smiled at her so forlornly that it almost broke her heart.
I came a long way, first on that no-good damn tractor bus, which I hate, and then on foot.
There won't be any more, Sylvia said, of other choices, will there, Jack? It really has to be that way.
No more, he said, nodding emphatically.
She went over to the table then, and bending, kissed him on the forehead.
Thanks, he said, taking hold of her by the wrist. That feels good.
She could feel his fatigue. It traveled from him into her.
You need a good meal, she said. I've never seen you so crushed.
It occurred to her then that he might have had a new bout with his mental illness from the past, his schizophrenia. That would go far in explaining things, but she did not want to press him on the subject. Instead, she said, we'll go to bed early tonight, okay? He nodded in a vague fashion, sipping his iced tea.
Are you glad now, she asked, that you came back here?
Or have you changed your mind, she wondered.
I'm glad, he said, and his tone was strong and firm. Obviously he meant it.
You get to see Grandfather Leo before he goes, she began.
A scream made her jump, turn to face Jack. He was on his feet.
Next door, the Steiner house.
He pushed past her. They both ran outside.
At the front door of the Steiner house, one of the Steiner girls met them.
My brother!
She and Jack pushed past the child and into the house.
Sylvia did not understand what she saw, but Jack seemed to. He took hold of her hand, stopped her from going any farther.
The living room was filled with Bleakmen, and in their midst she saw part of a living creature, an old man only from the chest on up. The rest of him became a tangle of pumps and hoses and dials, machinery that clicked away, unceasingly active. It kept the old man alive. She realized that in an instant. The missing portion of him had been replaced by it. Oh, God, she thought. Who or what was it, sitting there with a smile on its withered face? Now it spoke to them.
Jack Bolin, it rasped,
and its voice issued from a mechanical speaker out of the machinery, not from its mouth.
I am here to say goodbye to my mother.
It paused, and she heard the machinery speed up as if it were laboring.
Now I can thank you,
the old man said. Jack, standing by her, holding her hand, said, For what? I didn't do anything for you.
Yes, I think so.
The thing seated there nodded to the Bleakman, and they pushed it and its machinery closer to Jack, and straightened it so that it faced him directly.
In my opinion.
It lapsed into silence, and then it resumed, more loudly now.
You tried to communicate with me many years ago. I appreciate that.
It wasn't long ago, Jack said. Have you forgotten? You came back to us. It was just today. This is your distant past, when you were a boy. She said to her husband, Who is it? Manfred. Putting her hands to her face, she covered her eyes. She could not bear to look any longer. Did you escape Amweb? Jack asked it.
Yes,
it hissed with a gleeful tremor.
I am with my friends.
It pointed to the Bleakmen who surrounded it.
Jack, Sylvia said, take me out of here, please, I can't stand it.
She clung to him, and he then led her from the Steiner house, out once more into the evening darkness. Both Leo and David met them, agitated and frightened.
Say, son, Leo said, what happened? What was that woman screaming about?
Jack said, it's all over, everything's okay. To Sylvia, he said, she must have run outside, she didn't understand at first. Shivering, Sylvia said, I don't understand either, and I don't want to, don't try to explain it to me. She returned to the stove, turning down the burners, looking into pots to see what had burned. Don't worry, Jack said, patting her. She tried to smile. It probably won't happen again, Jack said, but even if it does... Thanks, she said. I thought when I first saw him that it was his father, Norbert Steiner. That's what frightened me so. We'll have to get a flashlight and hunt around for Erna Steiner, Jack said. We want to be sure she's all right. Yes, she said. You and Leo go and do that while I finish here. I have to stay with the dinner or it'll be spoiled. The two men with a flashlight left the house. David stayed with her, helping her set the table. Where will you be, she wondered as she watched her son. When you're old like that, all hacked away and replaced by machinery, will you be like that too? We're better off not being able to look ahead, she said to herself. Thank God we can't see.
I wish I could have gone out, David was complaining. Why can't you tell me what it was that made Mrs. Steiner yell like that?
Sylvia said, maybe someday. But not now, she said to herself. It's too soon for any of us. Dinner was ready now, and she went out automatically onto the porch to call Jack and Leo, knowing even as she did so that they would not come. They were far too busy, they had too much to do. But she called them anyhow, because it was her job. In the darkness of the Martian night, her husband and father-in-law searched for Erna Steiner. Their light flashed here and there, and their voices could be heard, businesslike and competent and patient. This concludes the reading of Martian Time Slip by Philip K. Dick. This book was read by Tom Parker. If you would like to obtain a mail-order catalog or additional information about our growing line of audiobooks, write Blackstone Audiobooks, Post Office Box 969, Ashland, Oregon, zip code 97520, or call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. Please wind or rewind the tape so as to make the book ready for the next person to enjoy. Thank you.